I want you to picture this scenario. You are sitting in a hospital room. Maybe you are the patient, or maybe you're visiting someone you care about.
Right, and it's usually quiet except for that rhythmic beeping.
Exactly. The monitors, you smell the antiseptic, and you find yourself just staring at that plastic bag hanging on the metal pole next to the bed.
The IV drip.
Yeah, the IV drip. It looks so, I don't know, passive, right? Just a bag of salt water, a clear plastic tube, and gravity doing its thing.
It feels like the most low-tech object in the room, to be honest.
Right. But that is our mission for today's deep dive. We are unpacking the hidden science of that drip. Because it is not what it seems.
Not at all. I mean, it does look simple, and that is the design intent. It's supposed to be unobtrusive.
Yeah.
But if you peel back the layers of what is happening inside that plastic tubing, you aren't looking at a simple bag of water.
You're looking at a machine.
Exactly. A machine without moving parts. It's a high-stakes engineering challenge involving fluid dynamics, some very tricky displacement physics, and a level of chemical precision that is honestly kind of mind-blowing.
It really is. I've been reading through a stack of fascinating sources for this one. We are looking at advanced nursing skills manuals from Cobbett, hospital policy documents from the Vancouver Island Health Authority, and a really dense pharmaceutical calculation guide by Picar.
Lots of math in that one.
So much math. But it completely changed my view of that passive bag. And we are going to use these sources to basically bust a few myths today.
I love myth busting. Let's do it.
We're going to unpack why some IV bags are hung higher than others. Spoiler, it is not just for aesthetics.
Nope.
We're going to look at the hidden math of mixing powdered drugs, which was a huge headache for me to wrap my head around.
It's surprisingly complex, yeah.
And we are going to reveal a surprising fact about those IV bags, a little conspiracy or, well, a manufacturing reality. They don't actually contain the amount of liquid the label says they do.
That is a fun one to get into.
It actually made me a little angry when I first read it. But before we get to the deceptive labels, let's start with the setup itself, the architecture of the drip.
The double bag situation.
Yes, I think most of us have seen this. You have the big liter bag of saline hanging there, usually lower down. And then the nurse comes in with a smaller bag, maybe antibiotics or something, and hangs it significantly higher up on the pole.
Right. In the clinical world, and specifically in the Cobbett manual, this is called an intermittent infusion, or more commonly, a piggyback setup.
A piggyback. It's a great term because it describes exactly what's happening physically.
It is very descriptive.
Yeah.
The little bag literally rides on the line of the big bag. The idea here is that the patient, you don't always need that specific medication running 24/7.
Okay.
Sometimes you just need a dose of antibiotics, say, every 6 hours. And
Yeah.
you really don't want to poke the patient with a new needle every single time you need to give a dose.
No, absolutely not.
So you use the main IV line that's already there, the primary line, and you piggyback the medication onto it.
Okay, but here is what I noticed in the diagrams from the Cobbett source. The little bag, the piggyback bag with the meds is always hung higher. Like there is a specific extension hook used just to drop the main bag lower.
Yes, there is.
Why? I mean, is it just so the top bag drains first?
It is, but we need to talk about why it drains first. Because it's not magic and it's not electronic.
It's just gravity, right?
Pure hydrostatics. Gravity exerts pressure. The higher the column of fluid, the greater the gravitational pressure pushing the fluid down the tube.
So it's essentially a pressure war between the two bags.
Exactly. The top bag has the high ground, it has more potential energy.
Well, right, but here's the part that confused me initially. Both of these bags connect to the exact same tube eventually. If the top bag is pushing harder, why doesn't the fluid just shoot up into the lower bag?
The backwash problem.
Yeah. Why doesn't the antibiotic backwash into the saline bag instead of going into the patient's arm?
That is the critical engineering question. If that happened, you would contaminate your entire primary supply. So there is a piece of hidden technology inside the tubing.
The back check valve.
The back check valve. It's usually located on the main line, right above where the piggyback line connects.
Okay, in the diagrams, it just looks like a little plastic bulb. What is actually happening inside there?
Think of it as a traffic cop. A traffic cop that only responds to pressure. Inside that little bulb is a diaphragm. When you open the clamp on that higher piggyback bag, the fluid comes rushing down with superior pressure because of the height difference.
Because it has the high ground.
Right. That pressure hits the back check valve on the main line and physically forces the diaphragm shut.
Oh, wow. So the pressure from the top bag effectively slams the door on the bottom bag.
Precisely. You don't have to turn off the main IV manually. The physics does it for you automatically.
That's incredible.
The medication flows in and the main hydration stops because the valve is pinned shut by the pressure of the antibiotic.
Mm.
That is brilliant automation. But here's the beauty of the system. Once that top bag runs dry, the pressure disappears, right?
Correct. The very moment the piggyback bag is empty, that superior gravitational pressure vanishes.
And the traffic cop lets the other lane go.
Exactly. The back check valve senses that drop. Now, the pressure from the lower main bag is the strongest force in the system again, so it pushes the diaphragm back open, and the main saline bag starts flowing again automatically.
Which ensures the patient is never just sitting there with a dry line.
And that is a major safety issue. The hospital policy documents are very clear on this. You need to keep the vein patent.
Patent meaning open.
Right, open and unobstructed. If the flow stops for too long, blood can back up into the catheter tip, it clots, and you lose the IV site entirely.
And then you have to stick the patient with a needle all over again.
Which introduces infection risk, it causes pain, it wastes time. So this gravity-driven system is just an elegant, non-electronic way to ensure continuous flow. Gravity acts as the switch.
I love that. Gravity as an automated switch. But let's shift gears to the chemistry side of things. Because the PICAR source, this pharmaceutical calculation guide, this is where I started to get a headache.
The math gets intense.
It does. I always assumed drugs just came as liquids. You know, you draw it up in a syringe, you inject it into the bag, and you're done.
A lot of people think that. But many medications, especially antibiotics like penicillin or azithromycin, they are actually chemically unstable in liquid form.
Unstable how? Like they're going to explode?
No, they're not explode, but they degrade. If you ship them as a liquid, they would lose all their medical potency before they ever reach the hospital shelf. So they are manufactured and shipped as a dry powder in a little glass vial.
Okay, that makes sense. And like how we buy powdered milk or hot chocolate mix, it just lasts longer in the pantry?
PICAR actually uses the hot chocolate analogy in the text. You have the solute, that's the powder, and the solvent or diluent, which is usually sterile water or saline.
And the nurse has to be the barista.
Basically, yes. They have to mix them right before giving them to the patient. This process is called reconstitution.
Okay, mixing powder and water seems easy enough. But you flag something in the text called the displacement factor. This sounds like where the math starts to get tricky.
This is exactly where mistakes can happen if you aren't paying attention to the physics of matter.
Hmm.
Let's look at the example from the source regarding azithromycin.
Okay.
Say you have a vial with 500 milligrams of powder. The instructions say to add 4.8 milliliters of sterile water.
All right. So doing the basic math, if I have a vial and I add 4.8 milliliters of water, I should end up with 4.8 milliliters of liquid.
And that is the trap. You don't. You end up with 5.8 milliliters of liquid.
4.8 milliliters of water became 5.0 milliliters of solution. Where did the extra 0.2 milliliters come from?
The powder itself.
The powder.
Yes. It's a solid. It takes up space. It has volume. When it dissolves into the water, it doesn't just disappear. It disperses. In this specific example, the powder occupies 0.2 milliliters of space.
So the final volume is the water plus the space the powder occupies.
Yes, that is the displacement.
But why does that matter? 0.2 milliliters sounds like a tiny, tiny amount. I mean, if I'm making a cake, I don't care about 0.2 milliliters of anything.
In baking? No, it wouldn't matter. In medicine, absolutely. Because it changes the concentration of the drug.
Oh, I see.
If a nurse assumes the total volume is 4.8 milliliters and calculates the patient's dose based on that, the math is wrong. The concentration is actually based on the final volume of 5.0 milliliters.
So if you ignore the displacement, you think the drug is more concentrated than it actually is.
Or less, depending on how you run the calculation.
Yeah.
But the point is, your fundamental premise is flawed.
Yeah.
You aren't just following a recipe, you're doing volume calculations based on Archimedes' principle.
Wow. And the PICAR source took this a step further with multi-strength solutions. This really showed me the decision-making process nurses have to go through at the bedside.
Right. Take penicillin G, for example. You can take that exact same vial of powder and decide to mix it with different amounts of water to create different strengths.
Why would you want to do that, though? Why not just have one standard strength and stick to it so nobody messes up the math?
Clinical judgment. Imagine you have a tiny infant, a neonate, who needs a dose of penicillin. Though maybe they have a heart condition or severe kidney issues.
Okay.
Their little body cannot handle a lot of fluid volume. Fluid overload could literally be fatal.
So you need the drug, but you can't afford the extra water.
Exactly. So the nurse would choose to mix a very concentrated version. Less water, same amount of drug, They create sort of syrup of antibiotics so they can deliver the medication without overloading the patient's system.
But for a healthy adult with good kidneys, you might dilute it more.
Yes, because a more dilute solution is often less irritating to the veins. It stings less going in. It's flexible, but that flexibility requires the nurse to make an active decision and calculate the displacement accordingly. It's definitely not just add water and go.
It really highlights how much active thinking is happening at the bedside. It's not just executing a doctor's orders. It's customization.
Absolutely. And speaking of things that aren't what they seem, we need to talk about the IV bags themselves.
Yes. This was the overfill revelation for me. This part of the research genuinely shocked me. So let's set the scene for you. You grab a bag of saline. The label clearly says 50 NLO. You'd bet your life it has exactly 50 milliliters in it, right? It's a medical product. It has to be precise.
And you would lose that bet.
According to Picar, a 50 milliliter bag usually contains about 58 milliliters of fluid, and a 100 milliliter bag has about 110 milliliters.
Yeah.
They are overfilled.
They're heavily overfilled.
Yeah.
And there's a valid scientific reason for it. Manufacturers do this because the plastic bags are semi-permeable.
Meaning they leak.
Not leak like a physical hole, but at a molecular level, water vapor can actually escape through the plastic over time. Yeah, while that bag sits in a hot warehouse or on a hospital supply shelf for 6 months, a tiny bit of the liquid evaporates right through the plastic. So they add extra of the factory to ensure that even after sitting on a shelf for a year, there's at least 50 millimolars inside.
Okay, that is thoughtful of them. It ensures you don't get shortchanged on fluids, but here is the massive problem the source points out. We use electronic pumps now. Smart pumps.
Right, which are programmed by humans.
Exactly. If a nurse programs a pump and says, okay, computer, deliver exactly 50 millimoles of this antibiotic, the pump does exactly that. It pushes 50 millimoles and then it stops.
Because the machine naturally assumes the bag is what the label says it is.
But if the bag actually had 58 millimoles in it,
then you have left 8 millimoles of fluid just sitting in the bag.
And importantly, if you mix the medication into that bag like we just talked about with reconstitution, you have left a portion of the drug sitting in the bag too.
Correct. You have just underdosed the patient.
That is wild to me. 8 millimolars out of 58 milliliters? Doing the rough math, that's nearly 14% of the dose left hanging on the pole.
It is a significant amount, especially with antibiotics. The whole goal of an antibiotic is to reach a very specific concentration in the blood to kill the bacteria.
Yeah.
If you consistently underdose a patient by 15%, you might not kill the infection.
You just make the bacteria angry.
Worse, you might just stun the bacteria, which actively teaches them how to resist the drug.
So inaccurate labeling is indirectly contributing to antibiotic resistance.
It's a contributing factor if not managed right.
That's terrifying. So what is the solution? How do nurses get around this if the equipment is technically lying to them?
You have to outsmart the equipment. The guide advises nurses to program the pump to infuse the entire volume, knowing that it's more than the label says. Or you have to visually watch the bag and ensure it runs completely dry.
You just can't trust the digital readout.
No, you really can't. You have to trust your eyes. But even if you drain the bag to the absolute last drop, you run into the next physical problem, the tubing itself.
Ah, yes.
The dead space. The dead space. We tend to think of the IV tubing as just a delivery road. But a road has surface area. It's a container, too. The source mentions that a standard primary IV set holds about 15 milliliters of fluid just sitting inside the tube.
15 milliliters. That is twice the overfill amount we just panicked about.
Yes. So imagine the scenario. You have run that secondary bag of antibiotics completely dry. The bag is totally empty. The pump beeps complete. But the tubing from the bag all the way down to the patient's arm is still completely full of antibiotic fluid.
And if you just stop there and disconnect the patient, you're throwing away that 15 milliliter of drug that's sitting in the line.
Exactly. And if you combine that with the overfill issue, if you didn't account for either of those things, you could be throwing away 30% or more of the prescribed dose. It ends up in the biohazard bin, not the patient.
So how do you get that last bit out of the tube? I mean, you can't just squeeze it like a toothpaste tube.
No, you can't. And this brings us right back to the elegance of that piggyback setup we discussed at the start. Remember the back check valve?
The traffic cop.
Right. When the antibiotic bag is empty, the pressure from above drops. The valve opens, and the main saline bag starts flowing again. That fresh saline flows down the tube and pushes or flushes the remaining antibiotic right into the patient.
It pushes the payload through.
Yes. The nurse has to ensure enough saline runs through to clear that line completely. If you stop the infusion, the second the top bag is empty, you haven't finished the treatment. The flush is literally part of the dose.
It's amazing. Every single step of this, from the gravity height to the overfilled bags to the tubing volume, it all requires a calculation. It really fights against the idea that medicine is just blindly following orders.
It really does. It's constant compensation for physical reality.
Yeah.
And we haven't even touched on the human element yet. The sources, particularly the hospital policy in COVID, talk a lot about safety when the patient or their family gets involved.
Right, care in the community. People are sent home with IVs all the time now, and I can imagine the temptation. You're sitting there at home, the drip seems a bit slow, maybe you want to get up and go to the bathroom or just finish the treatment so you can go to bed. You see that little roller clamp on the tube.
And I think, I'll just speed it up a little bit. That is a terrifying thought for any medical professional.
Why? I mean, is it really that dangerous? It's just going into the vein faster?
Speed kills.
Yeah, really?
Literally. The PICAR source mentions potassium chloride specifically. It's a very common electrolyte additive. But if you infuse potassium too fast, it messes with the electrical signals in the heart muscles.
What happens?
It stops the heart.
Oh.
Yeah. Potassium chloride is actually the agent used in many lethal injections. The difference between a therapeutic dose and a lethal dose can often just be the rate at which it enters the body. If a patient at home cranks that dial open to finish early, they could go into cardiac arrest.
That is extremely sobering. It's not just water. It is potent chemistry.
Even with safer drugs, there is something called speed shock. If you hit the brain and heart with a concentrated bolus of medication too fast, the system goes into shock. Flushed face, a severe headache, tight chest, loss of consciousness. The flow rate is just as much a part of the prescription as the drug itself.
So hands off the roller clamp, folks.
Please, leave it to the experts.
Speaking of experts, there was one specific technique mentioned in the hospital policy that I found really visual, the push-pause method. This is for when a nurse is manually flushing a line with a syringe, right?
Yes, this is a great example of fluid dynamics in action at the bedside.
The manual says instead of just pushing the plunger steadily, the nurse should push, stop, push, stop. What? A steady stream seems way more efficient.
Think about a river flowing steadily. The water in the middle moves very fast, but the water along the banks moves slowly. It drags along the edge. This is called laminar flow. If you just push the saline steadily into the catheter, it creates a fast stream right down the center. But it might leave drug residue or blood cells sticking to the walls of the tube.
Ah, okay, so a steady stream doesn't clean the edges.
Exactly. But if you push, pause, you create turbulence. You create little eddies and swirls inside the catheter. That turbulence acts like a scrub brush. It scours the walls of the catheter to clear away any protein buildup or blood, keeping the line patent or open.
That is such a cool detail. It's not just about getting fluid. It's about how the fluid moves. You're using chaos to clean.
Everything in IV therapy comes back to physics and anatomy.
So let's wrap this up. We started today looking at a simple bag of fluid. But what we found was a hidden world of gravity-fed automation using pressure differentials. We found displacement math, where powder actually adds volume to the liquid. We found labels that technically lie about volume to account for evaporation.
And we found that the tubing itself is a container that can hide a significant portion of the dose if you don't flush it properly.
The overarching theme here for me is that nursing and medical care are not passive. You aren't just hooking someone up to a machine and walking away. You are constantly managing invisible variables: pressure, volume, concentration, time.
It really makes you appreciate the person checking that drip rate a little more, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The constant act of calculation and safety checks that keeps people alive.
Absolutely. So I want to leave you with a question to take home today. We learned that a 50 milliliter bag of saline isn't actually 50 milliliter. It's an estimate overfilled for safety.
Which leads to a very provocative thought.
Yes. If a standard medical measurement, something we rely on for life-saving precision, is actually just a safe estimate, what other standard measurements in our lives are actually just illusions of precision? When you buy a pint of something, or a gallon of gas, or a specific size of literally anything, how much of the precision we see in the world is actually just a label slapped over a messy reality?
It is definitely worth thinking about. Stay curious.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive. We will see you next time.